The 10 largest companies in the S&P 500 now represent close to 40% of the S&P 500 index. This is the highest it has ever been in a long time. And if you look at the biggest holding, Nvidia, things get even more crazy. Nvidia alone accounts for nearly 8% of the index. At this point, it is basically saying, look at me, I'm the market now. Because every time Nvidia goes up, the market goes up. And every time Nvidia goes down, the market goes down as well. And it is not just Nvidia. Apple, the second biggest holding, sits at about 7%, while Microsoft is close to 6%. This means the top 3 stocks alone already control around 20% of the entire S&P 500. Looking back from 1990 to 2020, the level of the top 10 concentration has always stayed around 20%. But then in 2020, the concentration started climbing rapidly. You could argue that it was influenced by the Federal Reserve injecting massive liquidity into the markets, or it was the beginning of the AI boom, or the fact that the largest companies were generating incredible returns and pulling further ahead, or a combination of all these factors happening at the same time. Whatever the reason, the outcome is clear. The S&P 500 is now far more concentrated than it has been in decades, and that is making a lot of investors nervous.
Nearly 40% of the value is in 10 stocks. That's a historic level of concentration.
The concentration is scary, and it's all around AI.
We have such an extreme concentration of market capitalization in barely more than a handful of companies. There's a natural tendency to want to avoid them.
Now, one really interesting thing is that while everyone is talking about how concentrated the US stock market has become, not many people seem to realize that many other markets around the world are actually even more concentrated. Take the iShares MSCI China ETF for example. It tracks about 550 large and mid-cap Chinese companies, and yet its top 10 holdings make up roughly 48% of the entire index. And it gets even more dramatic when you look at the top 2 names. Tencent and Alibaba together control almost 1/3 of the fund. Canada shows a similar pattern, with its top 10 companies making up around 42% of the index. The United Kingdom is even more concentrated at 50%. Taiwan's top 10 also accounts for around 50%, with TSMC alone representing about 25% of the entire market. Meanwhile, Australia has one of the highest levels of concentration, with its top 10 holdings reaching 61%. But even then, none of these come close to the levels of concentration that Finland and Switzerland experienced in the early 2000s. At one point, both countries saw concentrations above 80% in their top 10 holdings. In Finland's case, Nokia alone make up about 2/3 of the entire market at its peak. Quick pause. Speaking of market concentration, did you know that Moomoo offers access to thousands of global ETFs from the US, Europe, Asia and beyond? This makes it incredibly easy for everyday investors to diversify across different countries and sectors, instead of having to rely too heavily on just a handful of US tech giants. And if you want to dig deeper, Moomoo gives you further insights into each ETF that you are researching, including indicator analysis, top holdings, asset breakdowns, style box classifications, and much more. In other words, you are not just buying funds blindly. You actually get the tools to understand what you are holding and where your risks are. Or if you prefer investing in funds, Moomoo also offers a wide range of thematic funds, high dividend funds and more to help you diversify your portfolio. On top of that, you can even use Moomoo's AI tools to analyze your portfolios, highlight concentration risks and uncover opportunities that you might have missed. New users who sign up to Moomoo SG will get to earn up to $1,315 worth of welcome rewards when you fulfill the terms and conditions, which includes a $60 worth of Nvidia share. Plus, enjoy zero commission for US, Hong Kong and Singapore stock trading, as well as zero commission trades on US options every month for up to 100 contracts. Simply follow the steps below and key in my promo code KELWIN88 to get your exclusive reward. For more details of the promotions, do refer to the link promotion page in the description below. One study that looked at 47 different equity markets from 1989 to 2011 found that the average share of the top 10 stocks in each market was about 48%, which is almost exactly what we see in many markets today. This tells us that high concentration isn't something that's unique to the United States, but rather, it is a very common feature of stock markets around the world. The reason this happens is because stock markets naturally reward companies that grow faster than everyone else. The biggest firms will always attract the most capital, enjoy the highest margins, dominate their industries, and reinvest aggressively, which allows them to keep pulling further ahead of their competitors. Back in the 1800s, it was the railroad giants as rail transformed the economy. In the early 1900s, it was the industrial and oil titans. In the 1990s, it shifted to the dot-com leaders during the internet boom. And today, the cycle continues with AI-driven big tech companies. Indeed, this has always been the case. One study found that from 1926 to 2018, just 4% of US companies were responsible for the entire net gain of the US stock market, while the remaining 96% of stocks collectively performed no better than treasury bills. In other words, markets have always been driven by a small number of big winners. But the big question is this: is high market concentration actually a bad thing? Because the whole point of investing in an index is to get diversification across hundreds of companies. But when a handful of giant companies start dominating the entire index, it suddenly feels like your so-called diversified portfolio is really just a bet on a few tech giants. Interestingly, high concentration isn't always bad news for the market. In fact, one study found that when concentration rises, it often coincides with higher returns. Looking at the period when the S&P 500 rose from 2020 to now, the S&P 500 was giving back-to-back returns of close to 20% or more each year. And if it wasn't for the pandemic, a once-in-a-lifetime black swan event that triggered supply chain disruptions, historic money printing, record high inflation, and eventually the 2022 bear market, those returns would likely have been even higher. However, while the idea of a small group of companies driving returns is not new, the high level of concentration is also a double-edged sword. In a recent report, the IMF warned that the concentration risk in the S&P 500 has reached historic highs. It highlighted that a very narrow group of mega-cap technology and AI-related companies is responsible for most of the index gains. And if these companies fail to deliver the earnings needed to justify their elevated valuations, their prices could fall sharply, which would leave the entire index vulnerable to a significant downturn. So, does this mean that with such high concentration that we have today, we are destined to see poor returns in the coming years? According to Barclays, the answer is not that straightforward. Their research found almost no correlation between the level of concentration and the one-year forward returns of the S&P 500. However, they were also quick to point out that only 1.7% of S&P 500 companies have generated a compound annual growth rate of 30% or more in revenues over a 10-year period since 1990, implying that the performance of these companies could eventually moderate. Perhaps this time is different, and the AI boom could be a more sustainable driver of revenue growth than investors assume. But also perhaps it isn't. If one day the narrative ever cracks and the market concentration begins to fall, history shows that the outcome tends to be disappointing. Between 1991 and 2025, periods where concentration was high and then started to decline resulted in some of the weakest market performances, with the S&P 500 averaging less than 3% returns during those periods. This 3% figure reminded me of a paper Goldman Sachs published last year, where they projected that the S&P 500 would deliver an annualized return of just 3% over the next decade. And one of the key reasons behind their pessimism was the level of stock market concentration. Of course, not everyone agrees with this view. An analysis by LPL Financial argued that Goldman's estimate of a 3% annualized return is likely far too conservative. They point out that productivity gains from technology investments such as AI are likely to significantly boost the profitability of S&P 500 companies while supporting both earnings growth and valuations over the next decade. In fact, based on nearly a century of historical data, the probability of S&P 500 delivering better than 3% annualized return over any 10-year rolling period is roughly 90%. The only periods they have ever produced negative 10-year returns were during the Great Depression and the global financial crisis, where we saw two of the most extreme economic collapses in modern history. Who's right and who's wrong? Honestly, nobody knows. Forecasting long-term market returns is extremely difficult. If anything, this chart here serves as a reminder of how wildly inaccurate market predictions tend to be. Whatever the case, one thing that is clear is that valuations today are undeniably high. Right now, the S&P 500's forward PE sits at around 20.2 times, well above its long-term average. And while that doesn't necessarily mean a crash is coming tomorrow, It does suggest that the market is pricing in a lot of optimism upfront, which leaves far less room for error. JP Morgan's data illustrates this perfectly. When starting valuations are elevated, the 1-year forward returns are essentially noise. Sometimes it could be positive, sometimes negative, and there's no reliable pattern at all. But when you stretch the horizon to 5-year forward returns, the picture becomes a lot more consistent. Almost every historical instance of buying at high valuation levels has led to 0% or even negative returns over the next 5 years. In other words, the higher the price you pay today, the less upside you leave yourself for the future. And if you extend the timeline even further, the pattern only becomes clearer. However, and this is important, these charts come with two major caveats. The first one is that many people look at valuation charts and tend to assume price is the only variable, but they forget the other side of the equation, which is the earnings. When earnings rise, the PE ratio would go down, even if stock prices don't fall. Take for example, back in the 1990s, the S&P 500's operating profit margin was around 5%. Today, it has climbed closer to 14%. This rise in profitability is one major reason why PE ratios began trending higher in the 1990s and have remained elevated since. Even Goldman Sachs themselves, despite projecting only 3% annualized returns, acknowledges that forward returns could be stronger than expected due to demographic shifts, higher productivity, and technological tailwinds such as AI. And this is not the first time Goldman has been overly conservative. Back in 2012, they projected that the S&P 500 will return 4% to 12% annually over the next decade. During that period, the S&P 500 gave 13% annualized return. Similarly, the S&P 500 is also outperforming their 2020 forecast today. The second flaw in these charts is that they pick one starting date and compare it with one ending date to show us the overall return. However, that's not how real people invest. Instead, most of us continue to dollar cost average over long periods of time. Let's take March 2000 for example. This was the worst possible moment to invest. Its PE ratio was at the peak and it was right before the big crash. What do you think the 10-year future returns would be? The S&P 500 ended up giving a negative 30% over that 10-year period. However, if you had consistently dollar cost averaged throughout that 10 years, you would still have gotten a 3.81% compounded average return with dividend reinvested. Yes, the return is kind of sucky when compared to the 20% annual return that we have right now, but it is still nowhere as bad as we thought. Now, of course, perhaps by selling now, waiting for a crash, and buying back in will give you far better returns. But honestly, ask yourself this. How sure are you that the S&P 500 will crash soon? And how certain are you that you'll be able to get back in at the right time? History has shown that missing out on the upside is often far more damaging than sitting through the downside. 7 of the 10 best days usually take place in bear markets. And just by missing out on the 10 best days in the market, you have missed out on over 50% of the gains. So, are we actually in a bubble? On one hand, the signs are definitely there. We are seeing more and more secular AI deals, and now even Target has jumped into the fund. But on the other hand, corporate earnings today are not just healthy. Many of the tech giants driving this AI cycle are sitting on massive cash reserves while reporting strong demand. Take for example, Microsoft revealed that Azure's AI services have once again exceeded supply and that the company now holds nearly $400 billion in remaining future obligations, with customers locked in for an average of 2 years. Amazon is seeing the same thing. In its latest quarter, AWS reported that backlog grew to $200 billion, and that doesn't include several unannounced new deals in October. If you ask analysts whether we are in a bubble, you'll get every answer imaginable. Goldman Sachs says we are not in a bubble yet. Ray Dalio believes we are in a bubble, but we haven't reached the peaking phase yet. Then you have the rich dad, poor dad guy, who's been warning of an everything bubble every other day. And then there's Michael Burry, who tried shorting the bubble, but ended up closing his fund instead. The point is, no one knows for sure what will happen. Not even the analysts sitting behind multi-billion dollar Bloomberg terminals, backed by research teams, PhDs, and some of the brightest minds in finance. So what chance do we have as small investors when most of our research tools are just Reddit threads and YouTube videos? That's exactly why the smartest thing that we can do isn't to guess what comes next, but rather to focus on things that we can control. For example, we can diversify not just within the S&P 500, but across global markets, So our returns don't depend on just a handful of US tech giants. We can also reduce our risk by trimming oversized positions, avoiding leverage, and resisting the urge to chase whatever is skyrocketing on social media this week. And if we need more stability in our financial plan, we can include other asset classes like bonds, gold, or other safer asset classes, which can smooth out the volatility of our portfolio. Because at the end of the day, the goal isn't to perfectly predict bubbles or crashes, but to build a portfolio that can survive them. If you can stay diversified, stay disciplined, and stick to a system that matches your goals and time horizon, you end up in a far stronger position than someone trying to outsmart the market based on headlines and hunches. And that, more than any forecast or bubble prediction, is what ultimately determines long-term success. Anyway, that's all for this video. Hope you found this useful. Like, share, and subscribe, as I'll be posting new videos every week.